Sylvia Townsend Warner, Dorset Stories, 2006. A whole region or domain of English literature is populated by great eccentrics. I imagine a hilly, spacious landscape of farm and forest, with no cities or main roads, but many beautiful isolated houses, each occupied by a hermit of genius. Thomas Love Peacock, George Borrow, Forrest Reed, T.H. White, Sylvia Townsend Warner. It is not that these writers were unaware of the literary fashions and techniques of their time, not at all. They knew quite well where the bright lights were, but they preferred to cultivate their garden. Such purity of aim keeps their work singularly fresh, but puts it at risk both during the author's life and after. Fictions that can't be conveniently shoved into publishers' or critics' pigeonholes get such diminishing labels as marginal or feminist or regional, which permit professors to ignore them and pundits to snub them. And Sylvia Townsend Warner's work suffered an extra measure of estrangement. In the 1930s, The New Yorker very cannily asked her for first refusal of her stories, and the arrangement lasted till her death in 1978. The large circulation and literary cachet of that magazine ensured that she became well known as a story writer in America. But in England, though the stories were reprinted in collections by British publishers, she appears to have been considered chiefly as a novelist, and her novels were mostly not published in America. This division of her reputation was surely harmful in the long run. Whatever the cause, her books seldom found publishers who kept them in print. When I heard that Black Dog Books was about to publish a collection of her Dorset stories under that title, I couldn't wait to see it. If any of her volumes of stories were in print in England, they hadn't made it over to the States. Here, her reputation very largely died with her. Indeed, it's surprising that she ever was a New Yorker star, her work being very British in tone, style, locale, and sense of humor. I had the great good fortune to be introduced to Sylvia Townsend Warner late in her life, in her damp, tobacco-smoke-varnished naiad of a house, which was in Maiden Newton on the River Frome, and also from time to time when the river flooded in it. She was very old, very tired, very kind. I told her I couldn't remember the name of her story about the family who go on a picnic and end up wandering along a footpath. A middle-aged man playing a 50-pound music box, a lady carrying a birdcage, a girl dressed as Gainsborough's portrait of Arminia Blount, and a cadaverous small boy in a blood-stained Indian shawl. Because we've been following the perfectly plausible story, we have thought nothing odd at all about the music box, the costume, the birdcage, the blood, until the marvelously funny final reversal of point of view. Sylvia laughed, remembering the story, but she couldn't remember its name or what book it might have been collected in. It is A View of Exmoor, in One Thing Leading to Another, which might well be the collective title of all her stories. That is one of her most gently funny tales. Others are less gentle. Some are unbearably cruel. The very late stories about elves, collected as Kingdoms of Elfin, are among the strangest of her works. There is a lordly, icy, anguished indifference in them that chills the blood. Critics who confuse fantasy with whimsy and believe that only realism can deal with pain and cruelty should be exposed to Townsend Warner. She can cast a cold eye with the best of them. So I was hoping for a selection of major stories that might reestablish Townsend Warner's reputation on the level it deserves. The Dorset stories are not that. They are short occasional pieces, semi-memoirs, and minor tales, mostly from the 1930s and 1940s. Only a couple of them developed fully as short stories. Many are mildly or not so mildly satirical, and quite funny. Several have a dry, understated poignancy that lingers long in the mind. They are well chosen and wisely arranged to give a certain narrative unity. The book is handsome, elegantly presented, and Reynolds Stone's woodcuts are in excellent harmony with the text. It is a charming book, and though too slight to serve well as an introduction to her work, will be a treasure to those who already know her. And I recommend it to anyone who would appreciate a wry glance at village life and character. Not unkind, but, like all her writing, drastically unsentimental, undeceived. After this review was published, I found that in 1988, Viking, and in 2000, Virago, had published a selected stories, giving a good sample of her shorter work, including A View of Exmoor, the great story of incest called A Love Match, and On the Stroke of Midnight, perhaps her most unflinching statement of the impossibility of escape, the inevitability of loss and grief. Yet so little notice was taken of these collections that I didn't know in 2006 that they existed. Her first novel, Lolly Willows, reprinted from time to time, is a dazzling display of the extraordinary wit and tough-mindedness of her fantasy. Her historical novel, The Corner That Held Them, is harsh and splendid in its realism. She, who wrote an unsurpassable biography of T.H. White, was as fortunate in her biographer, Claire Harmon. And then there are her poems, her letters, full of wit and fire and charm, and her diary, the record of a generous mind, a fiercely observant eye, and an intransigently faithful heart.